Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Thanks, Kate. And I'm delighted to welcome now the Pulitzer Prize winning writer, Elizabeth Strout. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me here.
No, thank you. Elizabeth, people will know your massive bestsellers like Olive Kitteridge, My Name is Lucy Barton, and lots more. And your latest book brings those two characters together. It's called Tell Me Everything. So, Elizabeth, I'm going to tell you, it's the first time I've read one of your books. And what a revelation. Like, I thought of it as kind of like a stealth bomb. You have this very compelling story set as usual in rural New England. But in there then, quiet and devastating, all the big questions of our humanity, the meanings of our lives. Is that the idea, that stories are Trojan horses for the big questions?
Well, I mean, that's obviously my idea because I'm a writer and I'm interested in stories. So, yes, I mean, I think I'm just fascinated by everybody's story. And so I've chosen a few to try and tell in this book.
It feels like one big theme for you in this book, which is a big theme, I think, socially and even politically right now, is loneliness, and then the antidote to loneliness, which is connection.
Yes, precisely. That's exactly right. I think that there is a sense of, disconnection or something, certainly in our country and probably throughout the world, good heavens, right now. But there are moments of what I always call, moments of grace, where people do connect and can feel so much better just from these connections.
Yeah, in the book, Lucy Barton asks at one point, who is not lonely? Show me one person. Do you think we're all lonely in our own ways?
I don't really know because I've never been somebody else. So, I mean, I've just been dying to know what it's like to be somebody else, which is why I keep having to make people up. I think, I suspect people go through phases of sometimes feeling lonely and that probably at the bottom of everybody is a little well of loneliness. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Your own childhood, not lonely maybe, but it was quite isolated, solitary maybe is the word. Tell me a bit about
it. Yes, my childhood was solitary, but it wasn't lonely because I could run around in the woods, and I did spend probably the first 5 years of my life outside in the woods. I mean, that was back in the day where, if you came home for dinner, your parents were that's all you had to do. Mm-hmm. They didn't really care where you were. So, so I spent hours and hours and hours alone in the woods. And I've often said, the physical world was my very first dear friend because I loved, the pine needles and the wildflowers and the way the sun came through the trees. So that was a very good thing for me, actually, that isolation.
And no television or newspapers in the house either, I believe, which like for kids now to explain, this would be the equivalent of no phones or no Wi-Fi. How does that impact on you growing up?
Well, I think I look back and I think it was actually very helpful for me as a writer. Because I just was inside my head so much from such a young age, not particularly connected to the world and yet very directly connected to the world, if you see what I mean. I mean, the real physical world.
Yes.
And then I was deeply curious about people because I didn't see that many. So I was just very desperately curious to know everything I could about any person that, I did see.
I'm curious about the background to this of living in the middle of nowhere with no TV or newspapers. Were your parents kind of quite puritanical or ideological about this? The name Strout, I must say, does sound like you might have come over on the Mayflower, kind of.
No, we came over way before that. Sorry.
Okay.
No. The Mayflowers were, totally newcomers to us. But you're absolutely right. It was a very puritanical. The heritage or the culture that I came from was very puritanical and, watered down a little bit by my parents, but not much.
Okay. So, did they enjoy life at all?
That's such an interesting question. I think they did at times, but not fully. Did they ever really give themselves permission to just, have a great big belly laugh? I mean, sometimes, but it was interesting.
So then did you have to learn as you got older about joy and a belly laugh and that?
No, I think I used to think that there must have been some strange mutation of genes that had taken place because I just came out talking my head off all the time. I was chattering away, and I was really quite joyful. And I, you know, so I do think something sort of went wrong there genetically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when did you realize then that the genetic mutation also had made you a storyteller?
Oh, that was early on. I've always understood. I actually don't have any memory of myself not being a writer. I knew I was a writer. So about 4 or 5 years old, I understood that's what I was going to be doing.
Really? It took a while then to become a published writer, and there were detours along the way. You tried the law.
About 40 years.
Yeah.
I did. I did try the law because nobody was interested in my writing at all. And so I did try law, and I was a terrible, terrible lawyer for 6 months. Absolutely awful lawyer.
And then
I decided.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
Well, I just decided to commit myself, no matter what, to being a writer and just to tell myself, it at that point, I realized it doesn't matter if I fail. It just matters if I don't try with all my heart to do this. And so I did.
And then you spent years, like a lot of writers, years of rejection letters and working, waitressing, stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
You must be tempted to give up in all that time, are you?
You know, it's funny because I think there were only a couple of times that I actually did think of giving up. And then, I mean, but I just kept thinking that my last story was just a little bit better than the story before it. And that just kept sort of egging me on. And then, but you know, a couple of times I sort of thought I might give up. And then one time I remember coming on the subway and thinking, oh, well, let's just try the story this way. So I just didn't seem to be able to give it up because I just needed to keep trying and to keep going, and did eventually get, you know, a little encouragement from this editor or that, you know, so anyway, so I didn't give up.
They say with writers, nothing is wasted, really. The waitressing, doing stand-up comedy, all that. Do you look on all those years now as kind of wasted years when you could have been a successful writer if it happened quickly? Or did that all have to happen? Did you have to do all those things?
I am so glad that all of that happened. I am so glad I was not an immediate success with my work at all, because I didn't, you know, every single job I had, and there were many of them, every single one of them has added to my understanding of human nature, has added to my work itself. Years later, you know, there'll be something that sort of rises up from all those days of, you know, being a typist or being a cocktail waitress or, you know, all those things. They've all helped my work tremendously. So I'm really actually glad that I had those years of failure.
Yeah.
So to speak.
It's interesting what you say now, because I couldn't quite figure out. I was like, what is it that's so amazing about this? It's your understanding of human nature, and it's the fact that you're so non-judgmental of all these people and all their naughtiness
that's
and everything as well. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And I do remember that one of my favorite parts of going to the page is suspending my judgment on all my characters. I don't really care how badly behaved they are, because, you know, people are sometimes badly behaved. I'm just there to report on them, and to not judge them is so freeing for me, you know, when I go to the page.
It's interesting what you said there about that the reason you started writing is to try and figure out what it's like to be other people. That's the reason a lot of us read novels, isn't it? To try and get into other people's
heads. Yeah, but exactly. That's right, because very young I realized, oh, this is, in my mind at that time, I thought this is probably the only way we'll ever figure out what it's like to be another person, you know, because I can remember reading a book years and years ago when I was young, and I don't even remember what the book was, but I just remember thinking, oh, I've had that thought, and that was so fascinating for me that it was right there in print, a thought that I had that somebody else had apparently had, and I wouldn't have known it if I hadn't read it, you see, so.
Yeah. I'm not alone. I'm not alone.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Precisely.
Isn't it the greatest realization?
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yes, precisely.
And then, like real people, you know, often the characters in books can be quite stereotypical or superficial. They have a couple of character notes and that's who they are. Your characters are all these complex kind of beasts.
Yeah.
They all have stories. They all have secrets.
Right.
I was interested in, even in marriages, there are secrets. And this is a thing we don't possibly talk enough about because
Precisely.
It's awkward, right? You talk about the ghosts in marriages, for example. What are the ghosts in a marriage?
Well, the specific ghosts in this book were people that both partners had fallen in love, and the mother had broken up their marriage. And then it turns out that they, through a newspaper article, it doesn't matter the details, but it turns out that they had been thinking about each other for many, many years without ever communicating. And so that's when Lucy refers to them as a ghost in the marriage, you know, and that she wonders how many people have ghosts in the marriage. So, I mean, I do think we're all really complicated. And that fascinates me. I just find that so interesting. And I think we're even more complicated than we know ourselves, which is also interesting.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you think people in marriages need their ghosts and need their secrets, or do you think it's corrosive?
Or do I think it's what?
Corrosive.
Oh, you know, I mean, I think that depends on the ghost.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You're so right.
You know, I mean, there might be some ghosts that are very helpful to a marriage, and then there are others that are corrosive. So I think, you know, every marriage is its own universe, really.
Yeah, yeah. But it is interesting that we are moving into an age where I think there is a generation now who believe in full transparency and that there is no such thing as privacy, and it's a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you do find yourself looking at them going, you will grow up.
Good luck with that. And like,
yeah, that, you know.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, but yeah, you said it.
Yeah.
Listen, right. On marriage, tell me how you met your husband. He was a groupie, was he?
Oh yes, my second husband. I met him I was doing an event in New York City, and I was on stage with my editor, and he asked a question from the audience, and I couldn't even see him, and because of, you know, the lights. And then at the very end, he showed up first in line, and he left, and I remember thinking that should have been my life. And then we contacted each other. We met each other three times, and he moved in, and we got married a year later. We only waited a year to get married because we didn't want to scare the kids.
Wow, so romantic and impulsive.
It was really an amazing story for us. Anyway, it was astonishing.
Yeah, a coup de foudre.
Yeah.
Is that what they'd call that? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know, yeah. But it was just like, we were like, whoa, okay.
Okay, and it's still going okay. I'm taking it.
Oh, yeah, 15 years.
You know the way sometimes these things that start kind of impulsively
Yeah. But, I know. No, it's just gotten, it's sort of like we must have known each other previously almost somehow. I don't know.
Amazing, so lucky.
It is. We're so lucky, yeah.
And your husband, James, is a former politician. He's a Democrat.
That's right.
So America in 2024 is woven into Tell Me Everything as well. Like in this really subtle way that you weave so much together, but we get a little mention of house prices gone up in New England since the pandemic. The opioid crisis is kind of a shadow there. Some of the characters have a general sense, I would say, of malaise about the state of things, terror, one person has. I often think that writers see things maybe more clearly. They stand back than people caught up in the kind of waterfall of politics. So what's your view as standing back as a writer and an observer of where America is at now? Is it hope or despair?
You know, I think there's both. Both are going on at the moment, which is a tremendously tense situation, you know, to have despair and hope holding hands in such an extreme way. It's very uncomfortable. May I say, very uncomfortable.
Go on.
Well, you know, I mean, even one person. I mean, like for example, even myself, I can feel very, very hopeful, and the next minute feel very despairing. And I see that in my friends. I see that in different people of different factions. And there's also a lot of people that are no longer, even within families, you know, people who have different views of these things do not discuss them anymore. And so there's a breakdown of communication a lot, you know, and I do think that makes people lonelier because we're just more and more polarized. And it's very frightening, frankly.
Yeah. So we're back to kind of where we started. Like, does that division in America come back to that lack of empathy we've been talking about? People who can't imagine what it's like to be someone else?
You know, I do think so. And I just think, I mean, I always think that trouble stems from our inability to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. And it feels like this has gone to such an extreme now, you know, that we're just totally inside our own heads, or the heads of our of the people that we agree with, and that's that.
Yeah. And then loneliness and lack of connection. I was saying at the start, it's become a political issue. I think particularly for a lot of young men, isn't it, that when we look at people who become radicalized and go down these rabbit holes, that actually a lot of it is back to kind of bowling alone from all those years ago. A lot of it does seem to be loneliness and isolation, is it?
I think, yes, I would agree with that. And I think that there are so many, you know, societal things that have broken down. I mean, you know, churches are no longer really fully attended, and the different social groups that we, you know, would depend on years ago, they're just not really available anymore. And now everybody is in a state of tremendous anxiety and isolation. Yeah. Not isolation like playing in the woods isolation. Isolation,
yeah, you know,
social, in their head isolation. Yeah.
Yeah. In the book, Lucy and Bob both agree at one point that the US could be headed towards a civil war. Do you think that is a possibility?
You know, it's funny because when I wrote that line, I thought, right, let me put this line in their mouths, because I think Lucy and Bob would see it that way. And I'm just not sure. I'm not sure where we're headed at all. But I thought if I could write it coming from their mouths, it was a concise line, and it sort of symbolized, you know, what one possibility that could be happening. We just don't know.
Yeah. One of your other big themes is around class and poverty, and particularly the shame around poverty, maybe. And that is a theme we're seeing playing out in this campaign as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Absolutely. Absolutely. And there, you know, there's always been a class problem in America from the very start, and it's gotten worse and worse. And you know, and nobody really seems to know how to even talk about it, let alone do anything about it.
Yeah, it does seem to be at the moment that you either kind of blame those people for their situation or else you conjure an other. And you encourage them to blame the other, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly, exactly. So that's not a good thing, obviously, that's going on as well. It's all part of it, I think.
Yeah. Would you be willing to predict how things are going to pan out in, what, less than 50 days' time now?
You know, I just, honestly, I mean, I would if I could, but I don't, because I change my mind every 5 minutes. You know, I think, oh, this will happen, then this will happen. But so I just, you know, I really just don't dare say, because I don't know. I really do not know.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I think a lot of people would agree. It's terrifying. So hard to know. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, by the way, before you go, I believe you have at home not one, but two copies of the collected stories of our Irish writer, William Trevor.
Yes.
Why do you love William Trevor?
Excuse me, how do I know him?
Why do you love him?
Oh, why do I love him? Oh, because he's so wonderful. He's just such a wonderful writer. And I've been reading him for years and years, and I just go over those stories. Because, first of all, I think he's brilliant, and I think he knows how to use a sentence so quietly and so gently and just sort of flip it over halfway through, and you see, I just don't know. I think he's amazing with his sentences. And also, there's something so kind about his work. I feel, no matter what he's writing about, no matter what sort of distressing situation he's writing about, there's something very gentle for me as a reader to read him. I find him just wonderful.
That's so interesting. Again, kindness. Because I was reading the book and I was thinking, there's a kind of a Little House in the Prairie style warmth here on one level, even though all these people are real complicated individuals. But you are kind. There is a kindness in the way you write about them. Yeah.
I hope so.
There's lots of nice texts here. You have lots of fans, Elizabeth. Marina says, each of Elizabeth's books reveals human frailties with a dispassionate kindness. There it is. Elizabeth's Olive Kittredge was turned into a good limited series. The main character superbly played by Frances McDormand. It certainly was. I lap up her writing with a smile. Thanks, Elizabeth. Love her books. Delighted to hear she has a new one out. There's a New Englander who's been living in Ireland for 20 years, an avid reader. You're his favourite author, going into town to buy it now. We'll have it finished by Sunday night. Thank you, Elizabeth, for your books, which give me great joy and meaning in my life. Lovely to hear Elizabeth Stroud. I've read all of her books. She's one of my favourite authors. Well, look, I think people will not be disappointed by Tell Me Everything. Elizabeth Stroud, thank you so much. Tell Me Everything is published by Penguin and it's out now. It was wonderful to talk to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It was absolutely lovely speaking with you. Thank you so, so much.